Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Friday, March 6th, and this week we're tackling the world of sport, our first ever dedicated edition. I'm Maya, and alongside me as always is Alex.
And thrilled to be here, Maya. We've got a packed hour ahead, diving into the strategies, the stories, and the serious money driving the games we love. It feels a little like battlefield triage right now, so many major events and developments demanding our immediate attention.
Battlefield triage, dramatic as ever, Alex. Let's start with the Premier League. Is this finally Arsenal's year, or is Manchester City about to unleash another tactical masterclass? The finances are fascinating. We'll break down how spending actually impacts performance.
The data tells a story. Speaking of building a winning team, the NFL offseason is in full swing. The draft is looming, free agency is reshaping rosters, but what separates a successful rebuild from a complete disaster?
Good question. In shifting continents, the Cricket World Cup just wrapped. But did anyone really see that result coming? We'll unpack the key moments and spotlight the emerging players changing the game.
It's a seismic shift. And finally, to round things out, Formula One. Preseason testing is done. Can anyone realistically challenge Red Bull's dominance, or are we in for another year of Verstappen?
Ooh, Alex is getting ambitious already. I think you'll be surprised by what we've uncovered about the tech innovations. Let's get into it. Wayne Rooney scored 208 Premier League goals. More importantly, though, the analysis from Gary Lanker, Alan Shearer, and Gus Poyet this week points to something bigger than individual brilliance, a shift in what defines success in the league. Let's unpack the title race, the tactical stagnation, and the financial realities shaping everything.
It's no longer solely about expansive attacking football. It's about maximizing results within the constraints of a brutally demanding calendar. Poyet's point, football now is more intense and teams are playing too much football, is fundamental. The sheer volume of matches is forcing a prioritization of efficiency over elegance, which has ripple effects across tactics and player development.
Efficiency sounds like code for less fun to watch, but it's not just about fatigue, is it? Lanker framed the scrutiny Arsenal are facing as a compliment, which feels like a very polite way of saying they're a threat and everyone's looking for ways to tear them down.
That's a crucial distinction. The criticism isn't necessarily negative. It's a reflection of their genuine challenge to Manchester City's dominance. Teams are adapting specifically to counter Arsenal's strengths, and that's what creates the tactical arms race we're seeing. It's less about individual brilliance and more about collective strategy, and it's why City remains so dangerous despite their own vulnerabilities.
So Arsenal's success is actually causing the league to get tactically more rigid. That's a bit of a paradox.
It's a feedback loop. Arsenal's style forces opponents to react, and those reactions, often prioritizing defensive solidity and counterattacking efficiency, then become the new baseline. It's a cycle of adaptation and counteradaptation that ultimately leads to a narrowing of tactical diversity. The data supports this. Teams are increasingly focused on minimizing risk, even if it means sacrificing creativity.
Which brings us to VAR. Duncan Alexander and Mark Carey's piece highlights the skepticism around its expansion. It's supposed to fix things, but feels like it just adds another layer of controversy.
The core issue is subjectivity. The expansion isn't resolving ambiguity. It's simply shifting the debate from the field to the interpretation of video evidence. And as they point out, many existing rules already adequately address issues like time wasting, making VAR's intervention feel like overreach. It's creating a situation where the game is constantly interrupted for marginal calls.
And they mentioned throw-ins as a tactical weapon. Seriously?
Yes, and it's a surprisingly effective one. Teams are mastering the technique to gain positional advantages and disrupt the flow of play. The proposed changes risk unfairly penalizing those teams who have invested in this skill. It's another example of the league reacting to specific tactics without fully understanding the broader implications.
It's like trying to swat a fly with a sledgehammer. Okay, let's talk money. Jacob Tanswell and the panel at The Athletic paint a pretty grim picture for clubs outside the established elite, specifically Villa and Newcastle.
The revenue gap is the fundamental problem. Liverpool, City, and Arsenal are operating on a completely different financial plane, £702 million, £697 million, and £690 million respectively in 2024-25, compared to Villa's £378 million and Newcastle's £335 million. That difference dictates their transfer flexibility and their ability to attract and retain top talent.
Window-to-window existence, right? Constantly selling assets just to stay compliant.
The pattern is clear. Villa's reliance on selling players, even from the women's team and academy, to meet PSR requirements is unsustainable. It creates a cycle of short-term planning and undermines long-term development. It's a constant balancing act between ambition and financial stability.
And the new Champions League format just makes that worse, doesn't it? More matches, more squad depth required, more financial pressure.
It's a telling detail. The expanded Champions League adds more games to an already congested calendar, exacerbating the squad depth issues for clubs outside the established elite. In the new UEFA SCR, the 70% revenue ratio ironically penalizes clubs like Newcastle for participating in Europe, as Chris Waugh highlighted. It's a double-edged sword.
So qualifying for the Champions League actually makes it harder to stay competitive. That's counterintuitive.
It is.
While the revenue boost is crucial, the stricter financial regulations limit their ability to invest that revenue effectively. It creates a situation where clubs are perpetually focused on compliance rather than long-term growth.
Chris Waugh also talked about fans becoming financial experts, tracking balance sheets instead of just enjoying the game. That's depressing.
It is.
The financial pressures have fundamentally altered the fan experience. Supporters are forced to become amateur accountants, analyzing transfer implications and PSR compliance just to understand their club's trajectory. He argues it's unfair compared to the lawless environment of past club ascensions, where financial regulations weren't as stringent.
It's like they're being asked to do the club's accounting, turning passion into a spreadsheet. But let's circle back to tactics. Liverpool's struggles, as discussed in Football Weekly, aren't just about bad signings, are they?
No, it's a fundamental shift in team structure. The previous system was entirely built around maximizing Mo Salah's impact, and new signings aren't willing or able to function solely as supporting players. It's created a dysfunctional dynamic despite significant investment. Arne Slot is strategically managing expectations around this.
And the idea that the Premier League is becoming a robot style of play, prioritizing physicality over creativity.
That's the core of the issue. The emphasis on man-marking and meat walls and defensive tactics, previously seen in Serie A, is creating a league where teams prioritize avoiding risk over creative expression. It's driving smaller, more technically gifted players away, as they're less incentivized to play in a league where physicality is paramount.
Tottenham's crisis then fits right into that mold. A team built on confidence, now statistically underperforming and mentally blocked.
The implication runs deeper. Their winless streak since December 28th, coupled with a concerning 12 points from their last 19 matches, suggests a deeper systemic issue. The failure to replace Kane and Son, coupled with a subconscious belief that talent would organically appear, created a long-term strategic deficit. The fact that players are filling mental spaces with incorrect names like Mick McCarthy speaks volumes.
That's terrifying. Daniel Levy's tenure, then, is the root cause.
The pattern of disjointed managerial appointments and squad imbalances points to instability at the top of the club, as Ornstein notes. And as they revealed, Tottenham's lack of experience fighting relegation is a significant disadvantage. They haven't developed the resilience needed to navigate a prolonged survival battle.
So even with their financial resources, they're fundamentally unprepared for this situation.
They're a club built on ambition and attacking football, now facing a reality that requires a completely different mindset. And the fact that they proactively inserted relegation clauses into contracts underscores their anticipation of a potential crisis.
It's like they were building a yacht while secretly preparing for a shipwreck. Okay, let's quickly touch on Wrexham. Is it all just hype?
It's more nuanced than that. Their success isn't solely about investment. They weren't just any non-league team. They were a historically large club with a huge fanbase, making them uniquely positioned for a rapid ascent. But as JJ Bull points out, the narrative will fundamentally change upon entering the Premier League.
Less underdog story, more scrutiny.
Two things stand out. The focus will shift from celebrating their rise to assessing the disruption they bring to the established media ecosystem and the logistical challenges they face. And crucially, the owners' current intentions of sustainable growth will be tested.
Because realistically, a sale is inevitable, isn't it?
JJ Bull predicts it is if they aim to reach the next level. The financial incentives are simply too great. And the success of Wrexham is uniquely American in its appeal, resonating with a rags-to-riches narrative that is less prevalent in UK football culture.
It's like they're a Hollywood movie playing out on a football pitch. So to sum it all up, the Premier League is a league defined by intense competition, tactical rigidity driven by financial pressures, and a growing disconnect between fan expectations and the realities of modern football.
It's a system where sustained success requires not just talent and strategy, but also a significant financial advantage. And even then, it's a constant battle against compliance and the ever-present threat of disruption.
Which brings us neatly to the NFL offseason, where the same principles of financial maneuvering, strategic roster building, and the constant pursuit of a competitive edge are playing out in a completely different context. Let's just say it, the NFL offseason isn't about football. It's about preventing regret, right? All this combine stuff, the free agent buzz, it's just elaborate insurance policies against bad drafts.
That's a surprisingly accurate framing, actually. The sheer volume of activity, the combine, pro days, free agency visits, is less about identifying optimal players and more about mitigating risk. The league structure incentivizes constant roster churn, so minimizing downside is paramount, and that explains a lot of the seemingly irrational spending.
Irrational is putting it mildly. We heard Robert Mays talk about guards getting $15 million a year, $15 million for a guy who blocks people.
It highlights a fascinating market inefficiency. Edge rushers rightfully command premium prices because they're scarce, exceeding $11 million, but the unexpected inflation at guard suggests a positional value shift, potentially driven by teams overcorrecting for offensive line deficiencies. It's a classic case of supply and demand, but with a hefty dose of panic buying.
Panic buying. I like that. And it's not just the price tags, it's who's getting them. Tariq Willen, Devin Lloyd, Alec Pierce, the potential overpays list felt long enough to qualify as a small phone book.
Something to flag here, the consistent thread is inconsistency. These players haven't definitively proven they can be consistently impactful, yet they're projected to receive contracts based on upside. The DJ Moore trade is a perfect counterpoint, a known quantity even if his role diminished in Chicago, versus the gamble inherent in free agency.
Speaking of Moore, Brandon Bean apparently decided 60th overall was worth it.
60th.
For a receiver who wasn't exactly lighting the world on fire.
That's the value of certainty when you have a franchise quarterback in his prime. The Bills were desperate to address an offensive issue, and acquiring Moore guaranteed a known commodity, unlike rolling the dice on a draft prospect. It's a recognition that a receiver they knew could function within the offense was worth the premium, especially with Joe Brady coming in from Carolina.
Function? That's a very diplomatic way of putting it. The Chargers, though. Replacing Khalil Mack with Jalen Phillips. That feels optimistic given Phillips' injury history.
It suggests a long-term plan centered on a pocket-pushing edge defender, even with the injury risk. The lack of depth at the position likely drove that decision. It's about prioritizing a specific style of play, even if it means accepting a higher degree of uncertainty.
And the Bears, sitting on $30 million after the Moore trade, presumably ready to throw money at everyone. But Robert Mays proposed trading DeMario Davis instead.
It's a counterintuitive but insightful suggestion. Davis, despite his age, is still a valuable player, and trading him could net multiple defensive pieces equivalent to the cost of signing Tyler Linderbaum. May's point is that the offensive line market is inflated, and the Bears have more pressing needs elsewhere.
They're potentially overvaluing a position and trying to trade a veteran for a bundle of less overvalued positions.
Worth noting, it's a recognition that positional value is fluid, and that the best way to address multiple needs isn't always through directly targeting a single high-priced player. The cap space allows for flexibility, but also creates the temptation to overspend.
Mike Evans. The Ravens apparently think they can turn a declining receiver into what exactly?
Robert Mays reframed his trajectory as a positive, shifting from a big ball-winning receiver to a receiver who becomes a big ball-winning receiver within their specific scheme. It's an alignment of needs, despite acknowledging the unlikelihood of the signing. They need a red zone threat and are betting on his size.
Becomes. That's a lovely euphemism for we hope he's still good enough. What about running backs? ETN's price estimated at 75% of Kenneth Walker's deal, with a $3 million inflation tax.
The running back market is uniquely volatile. That $3 million inflation tax is a key observation. Valuations are artificially inflated compared to other positions. ETN's price point as a percentage of Walker's deal provides a useful benchmark for evaluating potential signings.
And Tyler Allgeier, undervalued because he's a specialist.
So here's the picture. Teams seeking an early down banger represent a specific underserved need. Allgeier's value isn't reflected in broad market analysis, making him a potential high-value acquisition. Robert Mays notes several teams could be fits, highlighting a broader opportunity.
Rasul Douglas. A time bomb with a helmet, essentially.
The risk of a rapid decline is inherent with veteran cornerbacks. Drafting replacements is crucial for protecting against a mid-season drop in performance. It's about maximizing immediate impact while mitigating long-term risk.
The Bengals' depth pieces like Joseph Ossai suddenly seem interesting.
Players from demonstrably poor units are often overlooked, but can offer solid, cost-effective contributions if identified correctly. It's about scouting beyond the surface level and recognizing untapped potential.
Tyquan Thornton. Apparently, he just needed a good quarterback.
Quarterback quality is paramount for receiver success. His contributions in Kansas City were tied to having a top-tier QB, suggesting he's a situational player best suited for a specific offensive context.
Bobby Wagner. Adult in the room. That's a very specific free agent pitch.
The Bengals' need for stability in a young room outweighs concerns about his declining athleticism. He's a veteran presence, a leader, and that's valuable even if his on-field impact diminishes.
Edge rushers. Apparently, you're either paying $11 million or you're not. No in-between.
The market is bifurcated, effectively eliminating the $8 to $11 million price point. You're paying for depth rotation or committing to a significant investment. The Armstrong, Wright, Kuntz, and Ebukam / Jones contracts demonstrate this dynamic.
Cornerbacks and team context. Chase Young's success apparently hinged on having two dominant defensive tackles in front of him.
His performance might not translate to a team lacking similar support. Cornerback value is highly dependent on the surrounding cast.
David Edwards, a former backup, getting $15 to $16 million. That's aggressive.
Robert Mays was surprised as well. It illustrates a shift in positional value, potentially driven by a shortage of quality offensive linemen.
The Chiefs trading McDuffie. Not about replacing him, but about resource flexibility.
It's about maximizing draft capital. They can potentially find comparable talent through the draft with the acquired picks, especially considering their success in developing defensive backs.
And the Patriots releasing Diggs. Apparently, the whole thing was a pre-planned microwave operation.
Derek Klassen asserts they achieved their goal of supporting Drake May's development, and Diggs's late-season performance validated the timing of the release.
So basically everyone is playing chess, but most of the pieces are made of smoke and mirrors.
We can trace that further. The Seahawks' willingness to let key players leave suggests a strategic shift under Mike McDonald, prioritizing schematic flexibility over retaining established talent. They're betting on their system, even if it means sacrificing proven players.
Which is terrifying, but also maybe smart. Look, it's all just a massive guessing game, right? We're predicting how people will react to other people's reactions, all based on historical data that may or may not apply. The fact that they're planning 6 hours of live coverage reveals they know this is pure chaos.
There's a signal here that's the frustrating and fascinating part. It's a dynamic market where the best laid plans can unravel in an instant. The unpredictability is what makes it compelling, but also why definitive predictions are so difficult. We can identify trends and potential scenarios, but ultimately it comes down to which teams are willing to take the biggest risks and whether those risks pay off. And frankly, I have no idea if the Bears are actually going to trade Demario Davis. That's why everyone is watching.
No idea. And that, I think, is a pretty good metaphor for the entire NFL offseason. Which is, conveniently, why we need to talk about the global game and the complete insanity of the soccer transfer window. So let's settle this. Was this T20 World Cup actually good cricket, or just a series of fortunate events masquerading as compelling competition?
That's a fair challenge, Maya. Good is subjective, but I think the consistent success of teams like New Zealand and India's current run demonstrates a shift toward a higher strategic baseline. We're seeing a move beyond pure power hitting.
Right, because strategic now means relentlessly attacking and dismissing the idea of cruising to victory. Sounds stressful.
Consider this: New Zealand, as highlighted by Fidel Fernando, isn't about individual brilliance. It's a systemic approach to minimizing risk, prioritizing relentless attack, turning players like Lockie Ferguson into tournament operators by assigning specific roles. It's about maximizing performance through team cohesion, even if individual stats don't shine.
So effectively, a cricket team functioning like a particularly efficient, yet emotionally repressed office.
A bit harsh, perhaps, but there's a kernel of truth there. It's a culture that prioritizes role fulfillment. But India's success is a different beast entirely. Bharat Sundarsan's Grinch analogy for Bumrah isn't about wickets, it's about actively preventing scoring, making him an outlier in white ball cricket. That's a game-stopping ability we haven't consistently seen.
And if Bumrah suddenly decides he's more interested in competitive bird watching?
That's unlikely, but the point is individual brilliance within a structured system. The fact that India is one win from euphoria, as TFW Daily put it, is a testament to that. But it's also worth noting Pakistan's journey or lack thereof. Their qualification felt like a backdoor entry that wasn't fully leveraged.
Backdoor entry is generous. Losing 8 wickets for 36 runs in the final overs suggests a team collapsing under the weight of hope.
Partly, but it also highlights the psychological tipping point Sundarsan noted, confidence inextricably linked to the scoreboard. And frankly, the controversial umpiring decision on the final wide could have altered the outcome. But beyond that, it reveals a deeper issue with Pakistan's consistency.
Speaking of deeper issues, if Sri Lanka keeps supporting opposing teams for economic benefits, we might see a new form of competitive blackmail emerge. First it's match fixing, then it's GDP fixing.
That's a dark thought, but it underscores a unique dynamic in this tournament, the broader context influencing matches. It highlights the logistical complexity as well. A win for Pakistan would have dramatically altered the semifinal schedule, shifting it to Colombo. But circling back to strategy, the rise of spin bowling is undeniable.
Spin bowling. Groundbreaking.
It's more than just a trend. England's success, particularly Rashid Jackson Ahmed, in South Asian conditions is unusual. They prepared in Sri Lanka, playing 6 matches, which clearly paid off. That adaptability is key. It's like observing a resilient ecosystem. The teams that thrive aren't the strongest, but the most adaptable.
If my garden started thriving based on a 6-match preparatory tour of Sri Lanka, I'd be deeply suspicious.
The point is the importance of player comfort in those conditions. And it's not just about England. Well, Jax is performing exceptionally well, drawing comparisons to Garfield Sobers from Fidel Fernando. His 7 wickets and 191 runs at a strike rate of 177 demonstrate that potential.
Jax is a modern Sobers who's just really good at not getting out.
A slightly reductive but not entirely inaccurate assessment. The partnership of 44 runs off 16 balls with Ahmed was pivotal. However, New Zealand's captaincy, particularly Santner's decisions at the death, was questioned by Jeff Lemon.
Santner making bad decisions. Shocking. Truly, the world is ending.
It highlights a broader point about the importance of tactical flexibility. But the success of teams like New Zealand and India also raises a question about the future of data analytics. It's not just about identifying matchups, as McConkie's performance demonstrated, but proactively shaping team composition.
TV analysts knowing a player's role before the players do. That feels unsettling.
It does, but it suggests a level of strategic foresight. Looking ahead, predicting winners is always fraught, but India and South Africa are currently the strongest teams. New Zealand and England have the potential to cause upsets.
But honestly, the one thing that keeps me up at night is the question of whether South Africa will actually choke in the semifinals. Adam Collins notes the dread felt by their fans. It's a tangible weight.
That's a valid concern. The psychological burden of past failures will be a significant obstacle. It will be interesting to see how Shukri Conrad addresses their mindset. But maybe we should switch gears and see if the engineers have figured out how to make a Formula One car that doesn't explode every 5 minutes.
Everyone was expecting a seamless transition to these new 50-50 internal combustion battery power units, right? A brave new world of efficiency. What actually happened in testing?
Frustration primarily. Carlos Sainz at Williams, despite his positive outlook, acknowledges the drivability shift is major. Specifically, it's the integration of the electrical energy and the combustion engine, demanding a complete rethink of gearbox setup and driver synergy. He even pointed to the 2021 cars as a surprisingly accurate baseline for feel, but with drastically reduced downforce.
Reduced downforce, but also a whole lot more to manage. We're talking qualifying laps potentially requiring 2 preparation laps just to charge batteries.
That's creating a tactical chess match around energy deployment. The podcast hosts highlight the risk of teams converging on a single efficient approach, potentially sacrificing speed for consistency. It's like everyone's trying to solve the same Rubik's Cube, and the first one to find the optimal solution dictates the entire field.
A Rubik's Cube with a constantly changing rulebook. Speaking of which, Mercedes, that engine compression ratio loophole.
It's significant. They've exploited a compliance angle that gives them up to 13 horsepower. The FIA is addressing it mid-season, which means Mercedes has a window to capitalize. But it's not just a straight performance gain. Ferrari proactively designed a smaller turbo to counter the start procedure issues caused by the MGUH removal.
Which naturally the FIA now considers a safety concern.
Stepping back, the removal of the MGUH created longer turbo spool-up times, and Ferrari's solution is under scrutiny. It's a constant back and forth, with the FIA reacting to innovations that address problems created by their own regulations.
And then there's the Stroll rule, a 5-second buffer at the start.
That's tacit acknowledgement that the active aerodynamic regulations create a dangerous disparity in launch speeds, especially for teams at the back of the grid. Ferrari's advantage was deemed too risky. It's not just about safety, but about leveling the playing field, at least initially.
Leveling the playing field, except Williams seems to be having a fundamental problem that isn't solvable with incremental adjustments.
Carlos Sainz notes that their overweight car suggests a deeper design flaw. He's committed to a long-term rebuild, but progress hinges on resolving that core issue. He's deliberately managing expectations, which is smart, given the complexities of the new power units.
It's almost reassuring that even with all the tech, it still comes down to basic engineering problems. Okay, final thought, what's one thing to watch for as the season unfolds?
The integration of driver feedback, gearbox development, and engine characteristics. Sainz emphasizes that success hinges on a collaborative approach between those 3 elements. And crucially, he recommends the FIA and FOM remain flexible with overtake mode implementation. If the solutions are universally applicable, we risk suboptimal racing. Specifically, I think the first 3 races will tell us a lot about how adaptable teams are to the new energy management dynamic.
Looking back at the Premier League's tactical convergence, the NFL's risk-averse offseason, cricket's embrace of aggressive cohesion, and Formula One's tech scramble, it feels like we've been charting a single unsettling trend. the relentless pursuit of optimization, even at the expense of spontaneity. It's not just about winning anymore, it's about systematically removing the possibility of losing.
The data tells a story. It's fascinating to see that impulse manifest across such different domains. We talked about Gary Lanker noting Arsenal's structure forcing rivals to react, and how that's shrinking the tactical palette. That echoes the NFL's elaborate insurance policies. Teams aren't necessarily drafting the best players, they're drafting to avoid worst-case scenarios. Even in cricket, India's success isn't about individual fireworks, but about a framework that minimizes error. It's as if each sport is building a yacht, but secretly preparing for shipwreck, and prioritizing the life raft over the luxury cabin.
And the money, of course, is the engine driving it all. We saw the numbers: Liverpool, City, Arsenal's revenue dwarfing Villa and Newcastle. That financial stratification forces a reactive cycle, demanding constant investment just to stay afloat. But even with investment, the system feels increasingly rigged against sustained disruption. Wayne Rooney's 208 goals feel like a relic of a bygone era, a testament to individual brilliance in a game that's becoming increasingly algorithmic.
The interesting tension, though, is that this optimization isn't necessarily working flawlessly. South Africa's past chokes in cricket, the Bears' unpredictable moves, even Williams' fundamental engineering issues, these represent points where the system breaks down, where human fallibility and unforeseen circumstances introduce chaos. And the question of whether data analytics is truly shaping team composition, or just confirming pre-existing biases, remains open.
It feels like we're watching a slow erosion of the unpredictable magic. Remember our discussion about the 15 million guard contract value? That's not about evaluating talent, it's about preventing a competitor from getting it. It's turning passion into a spreadsheet.
And the Formula One example is particularly telling. The FIA's reactive regulations are creating a constant cycle of adjustment, forcing teams to operate in a window-to-window existence, exploiting loopholes rather than pursuing genuine innovation. That 13-horsepower advantage Mercedes found, it's a symptom of a system rewarding clever compliance over fundamental engineering breakthroughs. I suspect the first three races will be a brutal unveiling of who's actually adapted to the new energy management dynamic.
So what should we watch? I think the Premier League's tactical evolution is key. Will we see a complete narrowing, or will someone break the mold? And in the NFL, will the Bears actually trade Demario Davis? That feels like a genuine wild card.
For me, it's South Africa in the cricket semifinals. Can they overcome the psychological hurdle? And long term, I'm deeply curious about Wrexham's sustainability as they ascend. But the biggest question, I think, is whether this pursuit of optimization will ultimately stifle the very creativity and passion that makes these sports compelling.
That's a grim picture, isn't it?
Perhaps, but it's a fascinating one.
Thanks for joining us this week. We'll be back next week to dissect the unfolding narratives.